Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute for Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week in Israel, we're reading Bechukotai, and it's Yom Yerushalayim. In the diaspora outside of Israel, this is the catch-up week, and you'll be reading Bahar and Bechukotai, and of course Yom Yerushalayim is celebrated this week. So in the future, in the immediate future, both in Israel and outside of Israel, we'll all be synchronized on the Torah portions. And as you may have noticed, that has not been the case for the last couple of weeks. So this week, Bechukotai and Yom Yerushalayim by Alex Israel. Rabbi Alex Israel is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Alex Israel.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Bechukotai. It's the Torah portion of Bechukotai. And it sounds pretty foreboding. We're talking about blessings and curses. Im b'chukotai teilechu, ve'mitzvotai tishmeru v'asitem otam. If you follow my laws and faithfully observe my commandments, I will grant you rains in their season, so the earth shall yield its produce, the trees of the field their fruit. Your threshing shall overtake the vintage, your vintage shall overtake the sowing. You shall eat your fill of bread, and dwell securely in your land. I will grant peace in the land. I will grant you respite from vicious beasts. You will give chase to your enemies. I will look with favor upon you and make you fertile and multiply you and maintain my covenant with you. Many commentators have wondered why the blessings and the curses are so worldly. After all, might we not expect it to say, if you keep my commandments, you will merit the world to come, and if you don't keep my commandments, you will go to hell, or something like that. Instead, what do we have? We have this promise that if we keep the commandments, we will be given agricultural prosperity, we will be given military success and peace, Animals will not miscarry, and neither will humans miscarry. We will have a population expansion. And at the end of the description, we describe how God will walk with us in the land and set his residence, his Mishkan, amongst us. A beautiful pastoral image. In the curses, we have the reverse image. If we don't follow God, first the agriculture will fail. We will have military attacks. We will experience fear and dread, and eventually the land will stop being productive. We will be attacked by enemies, and we will become exiled from the land, a land which will fall into a state of desolation. It is all so this worldly that we have to somehow come to terms and understand how to place all of this. Now, seeing as we heard Parashat Bechukotai, which we're reading this week, is the end of the book of Leviticus, the end of Vayikra, I'm going to try and put this in some context by relating to the entire book of Vayikra. And then I'd actually like to finish today with making some comments about Yom Yerushalayim, Jerusalem Day. We're going to make a few comments about Jerusalem, because on Saturday night of Motzei Shabbat and Sunday, we're celebrating Yom Yerushalayim. The streets of Jerusalem will be filled with revelers and parties as we celebrate the unification of Jerusalem and the ability for us to go and worship at the Kotel, at the Western Wall, and other things. So let's take a little look at Vayikra as a whole. Let's take a little look at the book of Leviticus. You know, when I ask most of my students, what is the topic of the book of Vayikra? They always say the same thing. They say it's all about sacrifices. And that's a little unfair, especially as most people, when they say it's all about sacrifices, don't really mean that they love this book. How much of the book does really relate to sacrifices? Well, the truth is that it's the first seven chapters describe the sacrifices. The next three describe the inauguration and the dedication of the temple. And then there is a very, very long segment about five chapters which deal with purity and defilement. Describe all sorts of bodily situations that create impurity, whether that might be childbirth or leprosy or all sorts of emissions of various fluids from human genitals, and ends off with even before that, we have segments which deal with kosher and unkosher animals. How is Vayikra put together? A wonderful scholar of the early 20th century, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, divided Sefer Vayikra into two. And he said that the first half of Vayikra, in fact, deals with sanctity within the temple. The second segment deals with sanctity outside the temple. Let's try and explain what we mean. One perspective of holiness or sanctity sees it as happening within God's house. We construct a house for God, and there we worship God by bringing sacrifices. That's the whole first half of Vayikra. Let's see how it's constructed. First, we describe the korbanot, the sacrifices. What exactly are we to bring to this holy house? What offerings are we going to bring to the Almighty? And in fact, the next segment, chapter 8 through 10, deal with the dedication and the inauguration of that house. But immediately, we go into questions of tuma and tahara, defilement and purification. And we wonder why that is. And that is because a person may not enter into the temple if they're in a state of impurity. They can only come in when they're in a state of purity. And I'd like to say something about this aspect about the temple. You know, sometimes people associate purity with good and impurity with bad. As if to say a person should always be pure, and a person should always be pure, and if we're impure, that's a really bad thing. I think this is a mistake, and let me explain why. In regular life, most people are in a state of impurity. For example, anybody who comes into contact with the dead, if you walk through a graveyard, you attend to somebody, you visit a hospital, if you attend a funeral, you become ritually impure. That's not the only thing that contracts impurity. As we said before, what about childbirth for women, menstruation? Anytime a husband and wife have sex, that is a situation which can generate ritual impurity. Now, if that were bad, if impure meant bad, tamei, defilement, it sounds pretty bad, but the truth is, all of those things are just part of regular life. So, what does it mean to be pure? Well, I think the answer is quite interesting. In temple times, when you wanted to visit the temple, let's take a step back. Why would I ever need to be pure? Why would I need to be tahor? The only reason why I would ever need to be tahor is because I would want to enter the temple. I would want to go and visit God's house. And this sort of casts the whole concept of visiting the temple in a new light. You see, there were all sorts of interesting restrictions when you went into the temple. One was that you go in without shoes. That's an interesting one. Another one was that you weren't meant to take in your money belt. You weren't meant to take in your wallet. Now, what does that mean? Well, I think it means the following. I think it means that when a person visited the temple, they put their life behind them. A state of impurity is actually a state of normality. Normally in marital life, in regular life, even on the farm where a farmer's dealing with dead livestock or what have you, normal life is impure. So when we want to go to the temple, the whole idea is to take a step out of life. We sort of, as we'd say colloquially today, We turn off our cell phone. We leave our wallet behind. We don't wear shoes. Shoes normally to walk through the streets and what have you. We wear shoes. But only in a place which is specially clean and specially looked after, there we can walk around without shoes. So really visiting the temple is taking a step out of regular life. Visiting the temple is a moment in which we put our normal life behind and we go to what might well be something like an ivory tower. We go into an arena which is specially primed and specially calibrated in order to give us a experience of the divine, a religious encounter. And through that, we take a step up out of our regular life, out of our normal routine, out of the bustle and the normality of life where we have to juggle 1,000 things. We have to juggle our work and we juggle our relationships and what have you. And we step all above that and we put all that aside and we have a moment or we take a few moments together with God. And in fact, that is where Sefer Vayikra begins. That's where the book of Leviticus begins. It begins inside the temple. And this is a world of Tamei and Tahor, a world of purity, which allows you to be in the temple, and impurity, which is the normal default state of every Israelite in the rest of the world. However, after we've described this for the first 15 or 16 chapters, what's fascinating is we move outside the world of the temple. In fact, the first chapter, which represents, if you want, the bridge, the segue from the first segment of Vayikra to the second, is in fact the ritual of Yom Kippur, where Yom Kippur, the temple service, the service which takes place inside the Mishkan or the Mikdash, actually goes to purify the world outside. Ki bayom hazeh chaper lechem letaher etchem mikol chatotichem lifnei Hashem titaru. This is the day when we all become pure, but not only those who are inside the temple, all of Israel. And suddenly, we launch into a whole set of laws which apply outside the temple. All the different laws about sexuality in the world. All different laws which apply within society, in the law courts, how to sow your field, how to leave the corner of your field for the poor, whether your clothes should be made of mixed fibers, whether you should love your neighbor as yourself, do not hate your neighbor, do not hate your fellow in your heart, attitudes towards witchcraft practices, and what have you. Very soon we find ourselves in the world of the festivals, of the holidays, where we talk about the idea how we have to Mikra'i Kodesh, we have to call certain days holy. These are not days we spend in the temple. All of these are Bechol Moshvotechem. Whereas certain rituals are limited to the temple, the idea is that wherever we live, Bechol Moshvotechem, we can experience Kedushat Hazman, we can experience the sanctity of time. There is not only a palace of sanctity, which is called the temple, we can make a temple in time, we can create sacred days. And in fact, we move on then to Parshat Bahar. And Parshat Bahar describes the Shemitah, the sabbatical year, which actually we are marking this year. And here, the entire economy, the fields, the agriculture of the land of Israel becomes an arena for us to play out values of sanctity, not inside the temple, not in the realm of time, but rather in the realm of space, in the realm of the land. Suddenly the land becomes a place where we can play out our reliance on God, where we can limit the mastery of man, where we can even the playing field between those people who are landowners and those people who are serfs or peasants, and everybody can gain a sense of equality before God. And we have this remarkable institution of the sabbatical year where we can create a sense of holiness, not in the temple and not on the days of Shabbat or on the holidays, but rather in the fields of the land of Israel. In fact, most of Bahar chapter 25 of Leviticus deals with the economy. and deals with charity, and deals with the way that if somebody has fallen on hard times and had to sell their field, or possibly simply is under financial duress and in debt, or maybe even has to sell themselves as a slave, that every single member of the community is instructed to give them assistance. So what I'm trying to say is that if the first half of Leviticus is dealing with a very specific type of sanctity, it's in fact dealing with not sanctity, rather tahor and tameh, pure and defilement, we find that the second half of Leviticus, first of all, is focused outside the temple. It's focused in the homes, in the living rooms, the bedrooms. It's focused on the hills and the valleys. It's focused on the weekday and on the Sabbath and festivals. And there we don't talk about tahor and tameh. We don't talk about pure and defiled, but we actually talk about the notion of kadosh, kadoshim to you, that you should be sanctified. And what does sanctified mean? It means to be part of life. It means to be involved in every arena of commerce and human interaction, to be fully engaged in work and living, and yet to elevate our lives, to create some sense whereby we have holy moments, whereby we can grant assistance to each other, where we can appreciate each other and support each other, where we fulfill God's laws in every avenue of life. And in this regard, what I would say is suddenly we get to B'chukotai, we get to the blessings and the curses. And I think these fit in so beautifully to the second half of Leviticus. Because as we've said, the second half of Leviticus is not temple-based. It is society-based. It is national-based. And therefore, if you listen to God's laws, God will give you advancement. If we follow the code of living, which creates us into a holy nation, then God will allow our nation to prosper. It will allow us to have peace within our land, will allow our economy to boom, will give us a population expansion, and we will see our entire national endeavor rise and flourish. And of course, if we take all of these gifts, the gifts of land, nation, prosperity, and we simply ignore God, God says, I will make your nation slowly feel that their sense of security, their sense of prosperity is eroding, because in fact our sense is that God has given us the land not just because we are the Israelite nation and therefore every nation is a land, but the land itself is a gift. Our very nationhood is a gift, and that we have become a nation in order to create a different type of society. Now I said I would, and I think this really does explain why we're not interested in the world to come in the book of Leviticus. In fact, the whole Torah really does not mention the world to come. I imagine that every single Jew thought that there was a world to come. And they thought that probably just because they'd come from Egypt. And every Egyptian was quite convinced that there was an afterlife. And it's fascinating that the Torah decides to speak to these people who have lived for hundreds of years in Egypt and not mention a word about the other world, because Egyptian society was so focused on the afterlife, so otherworldly focused. Judaism wants to say, take our world seriously. Love your neighbor yourself means take other people's suffering seriously. Don't say, oh, they're suffering in this world, but they'll have a good experience in the next world. We don't regard the next world. When you're in this world, take people's emotions, take people's pain very seriously. When you're in this world, understand that the economic realm, that the arena in which we live, whereby some people develop wealth and some people develop need, is a situation which is an opportunity for you to support somebody else. Understand that your agriculture can give you a feeling of mastery, and every seventh year you have to release your hold on the land. You have to release your hold on your real estate every 50 years so that you realize that you are not the master over the land. So this worldly approach is really sewn into the fabric of Vayikra. I want to relate this at some level to the whole notion of Jerusalem. There is a wonderful sculpture on the roof of the Israel Museum. It's by the sculptor Anish Kapoor, and it is a, now I can't remember whether I'm getting my mixed up, but I think it's a concave, very, very highly polished silver, huge structure. And it has an amazing effect. When you look at it, you see the sky at the bottom. And when you look up at the sculpture, it reflects back the ground. And Anish Kapoor said that what he really wanted to do, this is Jerusalem. And sometimes we talk about a heavenly Jerusalem and an earthly Jerusalem. And he said in Jerusalem, you see the sky, you see the heavens on earth, and you see the earth in the heavens. I can't think of a more beautiful way to describe Jerusalem. We talk about Jerusalem, Yerushalayim Shalmala, Yerushalayim Shalmata, the heavenly Jerusalem, the earthly Jerusalem. And indeed, Jerusalem is certainly a place whereby people see within the very land a reflection of religion, of faith, and people look, and people look for the heavens in the earth, and indeed see the earth in the heavens. But as we approach Yom Yerushalayim, this special celebratory day in Jerusalem, I'd like to relate it to what we have spoken about today. Because Jerusalem, of course, is the place of the temple. And the temple, in this sense, is beyond reach. It is the Makom Tahor. It is the place which we visit only when we are pure. It's a place to go to when we take a step out of life. Today, many observant Jews don't even step up onto the Temple Mount. And the reason why they do that is because there is still residual sanctity there. It's almost like a forbidden zone where they go up there, where they don't go up there, because they feel it's sort of still a place for God. And yet, in that case, is Jerusalem just like any other city? Is Jerusalem just a city like any other in the world? Maybe it's no different. When pilgrims came to Jerusalem in ancient times, our tradition has it that they would say Tehillim, they would say Psalms. And one of the Psalms they would say when they went to Jerusalem went like this: Shir HaMa'alot LeDavid, Samachti Ba'omrim Li Beit HaShem Leleh. A song of ascent, I rejoice when they said to me, we're going to the house of God. Pilgrims would be on their way to the Beit HaMikdash. They would be on their way to the house of God. In fact, they would have to purify themselves in a mikveh before they went there. But fascinatingly, before they get there, they make a comment about the city. And I'm reading here in Psalm number 122, and it continues like this: Omdot hayu ragleinu b'sha'arayich Yerushalayim. Our feet stood inside your gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem built up a city knitted together, to which the tribes would make a pilgrimage. Shesham alu shvatim shifteya, edut li Israel, the tribes of the Lord, a testimony to Israel to praise God. There sat the thrones of judgment, the thrones of the house of David. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May those who love you be at peace. May there be peace in your ramparts, calm within your palaces. It's fascinating. These pilgrims are going to the house of God, and yet what do they talk about? They talk about the city gates. They talk about the city which is knitted together, which many people see as sort of the sense of urban sprawl, that you couldn't almost see where the houses ended. So they talk about the extent of the urban spread of the city. They talk about the thrones of judgment, the law courts. They talk about the thrones of the house of David. And they talk about praying for the peace of Jerusalem, peace inside its fortifications, its ramparts, calm within your palaces. Palaces, ramparts, law courts, royal thrones, city gates. What are we saying? I think in Jerusalem, we're looking for something like what we find in Leviticus. Indeed, the Temple Mount is in that sense a zone which you have to prepare specially to go into. But Jerusalem is meant to be a special city. It's meant to be a place which isn't just a secular city. It's not also not meant to be a city which is pure, but it's meant to be a city which is holy. Why? because the values of the temple, the values of the Torah, are meant to permeate the cities. Those values that I just mentioned, the values of the thrones of judgment, the values of peace, the values of a city knitted together such that all the tribes could come there and there could be a sense of harmony and unity. And when I'm going to celebrate Yom Yerushalayim this Sunday, I'm going to be thinking about these themes because, as I'm sure we all know, just anybody who follows Israel in the news knows that those things are still eluding us and that we still have a lot of work to reach that state of peace, to reach the state of national unity, to reach the heights of justice, whereby we can fulfill the words of Isaiah that everybody will come to Jerusalem so that God can teach us Torah and they can learn from Jerusalem how to practice justice. We have our work cut out for us. Jerusalem to be a holy city is to be a place not which is beyond our reach, but rather to be a normal city where we can practice economic competition, where we can have human interaction, that we can do it better. We can do it with more compassion. We can do it with a greater sense of values. And just like the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, half of it deals with the temple. But yet the other half tries to create a holy society within the normal avenues of life. Likewise, Jerusalem has a very, very holy hub. It has the Temple Mount, which is the site of the temple. But in the city, we're meant to live with a regular government, with a health service, with bureaucracy, with an army. But all of those things we demand of ourselves. Our Torah demands of us that we administrate all of these different branches of government and of nation building at a higher ethical level, at a higher moral level, and that we can really call Jerusalem, not just Jerusalem of gold, but Jerusalem the holy city. Then indeed we should feel that some of the heaven is on earth in Jerusalem. Wishing you Shabbat Shalom and a very happy Yom Yerushalayim.
Thank you, Rabbi Israel. Thanks for tuning in. And we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.